Okay, we're going to make a start. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. This is an absolutely fabulous turnout on a non-term night. So really appreciated that you're taking your evening to listen to what we consider to be incredibly important issues. So I'm Beverly Skeggs, I'm the director of the Atlantic Fellows Programme in the International Inequalities Institute. And I'm very pleased to welcome our Atlantic Fellows here tonight as well. The Atlantic Fellows Programme is one of seven across the world, with at the moment 267 fellows in 48 countries. Do look it up, because we are mounting a very significant challenge to inequality in various different places, and one of our key themes on the programme is the digital economy. So it's with absolute delight that we've managed to get three of the experts in this area into the room. So first of all, and I'll explain who's talking when and how it's organised, is first of all we have Sita Penagudaranhan from the Media and Communications Department. She's the assistant professor here, and she studies privacy, surveillance, data profiling, and historically marginalized communities. She currently co-leads the Our Data Bodies project, which focuses on the impact of data collection and data-driven systems on the lives of residents in vulnerable neighborhoods in Charlotte, North Carolina, Detroit, Michigan, Los Angeles, and California. So she's kind of on the ground doing lots of really important work. Next will be Seda Gerses from the Flemish Science Council, who's a postdoc fellow in computer security and industrial cryptography and the technology group there, and the Department of Electrical Engineering, KU Leuven in Belgium. So really important engineering, sociological understanding. She studies conceptions of privacy and surveillance in online social networks, requirement engineering, she will explain what that is, privacy enhancing technologies and optimization systems. Her recent work focuses on paradigmatic changes in software engineering practice and the shift from shrink wrap software to services and agile programming. So I'm really looking forward to hearing about that and learning what it really, really means for us as we understand the infrastructures of the digital economy. Obviously, last but not least is Barry Lynn, who is now director of the Open Markets Institute in Washington. And let me say that they very gratefully flew all the way in to speak to you tonight, so very, very pleased. Barry set up the Open Markets Institute after being expelled from the New American Foundation after they were put under pressure by Google after he'd said something about monopoly control and privacy. He will tell you all about that, and you can look it up to find out about it. He is the author, and was one of the first people on this issue, the author of Cornered, The New Monopoly Capitalism and the Economics of Destruction, a really, really important book if you want to understand what's happening at the moment. And then again, way ahead of the curve, The End of the Line, The Rise and Coming Fall of Global Corporations. Barry writes on how the political and economic effects of extreme consolidation of power in the United States have influenced the thinking of policymakers and antitrust professionals on both sides of the Atlantic. So here we have an amazing panel of people who are really on the ground. They understand the infrastructures, the economy. They understand how to be smart, how AI is working. The hashtag for tonight's event is Smart Choices. But please put your phones on silent. Do happily tweet away, but put your phones on silent. And we will record this evening's event for those who can't be here, because we do understand it's outside of term time. And it'll hopefully be available very soon as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties. As usual, after the lecture, first of all, I'll ask the panelists if they have any questions for each other so we can get a debate going. And then I'll open the questions out to the floor. And there'll be microphones. And if you can say who you are and use the microphones to ask your questions so that we can capture your questions and the debate that we're having. Each panelist will speak for 12 minutes and I will be timing them. And then we will open and open for a conversation that I hope you'll engage with. So it is with great delight that I first of all welcome Sita to the platform. Thank you.
Thank you, Bev, my co-panelist, Seda Berry, and the International Inequalities Institute. I'd also like to extend a warm welcome to the 2018-2019 cohort of Atlantic Fellows for Social and Economic Equity, and I look forward to interacting with you and hearing about your work throughout this next year. Because we three speakers come from different communities of practice, I thought it would be helpful to quickly clarify that when I talk about algorithmic systems or artificial intelligence, I typically refer to old school data-driven systems. For example, credit and criminal risk profiling systems. And these systems are influential in that many of the new smart AI systems build upon these. I'm also talking about unjust, unequal conditions that exist now, right? So these old school systems and the conditions of inequality that exist now. And that impact people living at the intersection of social, economic, and racial injustice. I want to make three points in the time that I have that are really grounded in people's experiences. And I hope that they will spark some discussion between us and us. So the first point is that machines speak for the marginalized, and their speech distorts and misrepresents. So that's point one. So data-driven systems, as we've come to know from glaring headlines and moral panic discourse, data-driven systems are becoming more embedded in the institutions that govern our lives, and especially in the lives of marginalized people. It's not just platforms like Facebook. We're also talking about social welfare systems, public safety and criminal justice systems, and commercial systems serving consumers, including low-income consumers. They're powered by behavioral inputs, which are then processed by algorithms, and these systems adapt dynamically and make decisions about what or whether to serve, assist, provide, or help. In the Our Data Bodies project, a participatory project that, as Bev introduced, investigates data collection and data-driven systems in the lives of marginalized communities in three cities in the United States, my colleagues, Mariela Saba, Tamika Lewis, Tawana Petty, Virginia Eubanks, and I are struck by this manner of machine speech. In particular, we are witnessing the ways in which a criminal record and low credit scores feed into a person's data profile that a machine then processes and uses to define that person in spite of that person. So the story that I want to tell comes from Charlotte, North Carolina. And for way of background, Charlotte ranked last out of 50 large US cities for income mobility. It has skyrocketing rates of income inequality combined with historic segregation, mass incarceration, and the hollowing out of middle-class jobs. These factors have contributed to racialized disparities that exist now. And I should also mention that Charlotte is, I think, the second largest financial capital in the United States. Quincy, a 20-something queer black woman, lives in the 28206 zip code area of Charlotte, in one of the city's most deprived neighborhoods. She was recently arrested for participating in what's known as the Charlotte Uprising, a series of protests that erupted and that called for the end of police violence and for increased police accountability following the killing of Keith Lamont Scott. Sometime after this arrest, Quincy was looking for and really needed a job. And she landed an interview. During the interview, she was forthcoming about her record with her prospective employer. Her interviewer, forthcoming about his willingness to overlook people's criminal past. And it all sounded very promising. The job seemed there, ready, waiting for Quincy. A few weeks later, after being excited about the new job prospects, she received an unexpected call. She was told that the background check that the employer conducted came up with an arrest on her record. So despite having been honest about the arrest and its context, despite being the right fit for the job, she faced an unforgiving data-driven system that denied her the opportunity to get back on her feet. Now, in the case that I've just described, the machines and data-driven processes I'm talking about aren't sophisticated in some of the ways that artificial intelligence and algorithmic systems are talked about today. But they are deeply influential. They speak for Quincy in ways that are path-determining, not self-determining. Machines that speak for Quincy in spite of Quincy. In spite of Quincy's desire or ability to contextualize what factored into her civil disobedience and subsequent arrest, a machine that speaks for Quincy in ways that don't fully represent her or allow her to narrate her own life's history. In this condition, Quincy is caught in what Hamid Khan has called feedback loops of injustice. Criminal record, bad credit, no job, worse credit, further rejection, further criminalization, the cycle continues. But some of you will say we can use data and machines to empower, not disempower, to support a more equal society. And indeed, this is an incredibly common response or a growing discourse around data for good, ethical technology, community technology, and so forth. And so some of you may advocate for, say, more data collection about Quincy, more granular data collection that would allow her to escape the legacy of a criminal record or bad credit. But my second point is that accurate data and accurate machines can still harm. And I think the best example of this is the recent subprime financial crisis of the last decade. Internet tracking and commercial surveillance helped the subprime industry target buyers for risky, toxic loans. Lenders, online marketing companies, and data brokers all contributed to the compilation of accurate data profiles of potential subprime buyers. These profiles were then used effectively to effectively target buyers of these quote-unquote ghetto loans. A significant majority of risky consumers came from the same black or brown communities in which Quincy lives. So individuals living in marginalized communities were being targeted for predatory financial products that capsized the U.S. economy. And there's much, much more to discuss here, but I'll leave it for hopefully our discussion to move on to my third point, which is maybe we should be thinking about digital exclusion as an opportunity. So since the 1990s, experts, policymakers, practitioners, tech representatives, and even myself, have talked about the importance of bridging the so-called digital divide. We need access to high-speed broadband, because without it, we can't get a job, we can't access social benefits, we can't access services, we can't participate in the digital economy. We have a rich body of evidence that suggests if you can't get online, if you're digitally excluded, your disadvantage will multiply. But as we're starting to see in the research that the Our Data Bodies Project is doing, being included, being digitally included, is connected also with disadvantage. As we see with Quincy, we're digitally connected in ways that set us back. So-called digital inclusion is also a problem, because the inclusiveness is akin to coerciveness and control. And as Quincy later said of data-driven systems further on in the interview that we conducted, these digital systems, they're communicating, but not for our benefit. And she said, when it comes to taking money from you or when it comes to you needing information from them, they're not willing to give it out. But when it's giving information out for profit, they're going to do it. Given this, I'd like to propose that this idea of digital exclusion might also be an opportunity for marginalized communities. It's an opportunity because it offers us the possibility of time and space to articulate the types of digital technologies that we want, including data-rich technologies. And it's also the time, it gives us the time and space to articulate the kinds of technologies that we should refuse. It's this latter concept of refusal that interests me, because it's one that we don't often talk about. But it has been incredibly palpable in the stories that people have shared with us throughout the duration of the Our Data Bodies Project. As one of our anonymous interviewees said, I would like to un-Google my life. People do not want to participate and should not have to participate in technological systems that disrespect them. People want to live in a world where they're safe, where they belong, where they're loved. And if that means exploring what it means to refuse to participate and to proactively digitally exclude ourselves, let's create the space for that to happen. Thank you.
Okay. So next is Pete.
Can I want to hear it.
Ada, good.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. In fact, thank you very much for having me here, and my great thanks goes to the International Inequalities Institute and to all of you, fellows and non-fellows, for making this evening possible. Since it's late in the day and we're all very tired, then moving your arms is very helpful for your attention span. I will continuously ask questions during the talk. All you need to do is just put your hand up or down. You can change arms if you feel like that helps. All right, so how many of you have heard of artificial intelligence? See, that's exercise for everyone. Fantastic. All right. How many heard that artificial intelligence is very important for the economy? Okay. How many people think artificial intelligence is already here? Okay. How many think it's coming? Okay. All right. Well, we're constantly told that we're waiting for artificial intelligence, and I'm going to suggest tonight that waiting for artificial intelligence is kind of like the Beckett Spiel play, Waiting for Godot. It's basically artificial intelligence, as we're told the story today, is about creating a demand for an investment that is already in the process of creating an immense supply. So while we usually hear from economists that there is a demand and the supply follows, or there's like a dance between them, I'm going to argue that artificial intelligence is about a supply that has been invested in, for which we are requested to provide demand. Artificial has been coming for 60 years. But what we referred to AI 60 years ago was actually much more broad and expansive and different from its manifestation today. And this will probably hold for whatever is claimed to be AI that will arrive in the near future or in the longer future. And we haven't only been waiting for AI. This kind of rhetoric has been used before. For example, a consortium of tech companies in the 2000s said, we are to expect the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things disappeared around 2005 and made a comeback in 2015. What was also interesting is that while we were thinking about Internet of Things and also told to expect ubiquitous computing, what we instead got was social networks. What was interesting about social networks is that in the beginning they were said to bring democracies to authoritarian states, and recently they've been told to bring authoritarianism to democracy. Funny things happening here. There's an underlying logic to their argument that there is technology that is unstoppable and revolutionary and that we should be bracing ourselves for it. First of all, what is expressed as an unstoppable technological change is in fact a story about companies already investing in a technology and creating a supply. The objective of waiting for the technology is to create an expectation that its arrival is inevitable and its reception is a necessary condition for economic and social progress, and therefore, with that expectation, creating a demand. In the current case of artificial intelligence, the argument is that if your health system, your city, your car, policing are not smartened up with AI, you're going to fall behind. Hence, to welcome this technology in cities, health, and educational institutions, we should demand it and do so without much regulation. There's also a moral panic that we hear about surrounding AI. We hear it will deliver an industrial and market revolution, however, it may also cause some problems. These include, for example, according to one of the prominent organizations talking about this, AI Now, include loss of jobs, bias and exclusion, infringement upon rights and civil liberties, and safety in critical infrastructures. A short but worrying list. This moral panic is cultivated with industry-funded think tanks, often with very present ties with universities. And they start from the assumption that these technologies will come, but with some side effects. These organizations then ask us to not only expect these technologies, but to imagine how we will live with them once they arrive, how they should be tweaked to better fit our lives. I think one of the most recent manifestations of this approach is in efforts to achieve what is called algorithmic fairness. I will explain in a moment what that is. But if one would step through the short history of this topic, it originally started with the work of Oscar Gandhi, who was theorizing about social sorting, where he said, with automated systems, we're able to better understand the populations and decide who is more desirable and who is not, and start sorting out the ones that are not very profitable. If all the systems start doing this, then we end up socially sorting some parts of the population. However, the work on algorithmic fairness, which kind of follows, at least in topic from this, has landed somewhere far from it. Current notions of algorithmic fairness, which tries to achieve fair treatment of, let's say, all people affected by an algorithm, is about building on work that's about 10 years old about algorithmic discrimination. However, the title, algorithmic discrimination itself, was very quickly transformed into a technocratic form, retitled to be called bias and algorithmic fairness, so removing the word discrimination, and with that, any sort of reference to political struggles and existing movements, etc. In its final form, algorithmic fairness refers to providing assurances that error rates of machine learning algorithms, so let's say an algorithm is making some errors, make sure that those errors don't disproportionately affect certain subpopulations, especially those who are historically marginalized. So if machine learning algorithms make mistakes, then you don't want the marginalized communities to be more affected by these than other populations. This approach to what I will say error is error tweaking, we are told, is sufficient to address the colossal problems that may occur if algorithms and the systems they're embedded in may amplify existing inequalities and introduce new ones. What is significant in these framings of artificial intelligence is that they allow those engaged in the topic from avoiding naming actual actors and engaging in the political economy of artificial intelligence. So we don't need to talk about the companies, we don't need to talk about actual parties involved in making these technologies happen, we don't need to talk about the investors, we can talk about AI, we can talk about algorithms, we can talk about data, and these things have problems and then companies use them, and so we need to talk about them in this abstract form. So in this form of representation, technologies become these abstract disembodied things that come to being neutrally, only to be colored by the shortcomings of the world around them. This manifests itself in statements like algorithms are not biased, but the data sets, which are collected from all of us, represent our biases and they reflect, and the algorithms reflect these biases. Algorithms in that sense, in such discussions, are presented like mirrors and reflect our current situation back to us. And even if algorithms can be unfair, because it apparently is a concern, it is an accident rather than a condition enabled by the ways in which we produce knowledge and technology. As an alternative way of looking at the whole AI thing, I propose an analysis that takes AI not as a thing that is coming, but as referring to a set of practices in software engineering and systems development that is made possible due to very concrete socioeconomic production decisions. Namely, I locate some of the origins of the current discussion on artificial intelligence in the shift of engineering from shrink wrap software and PCs, this was already announced, to services and clouds. And here we're going to use your arms again. Who knows what shrink wrap software is? All right, let me help you out. How many of you have installed software? There we go. How many of you used a DVD to install software? A CD? Diskettes? Tapes? Okay, that was giving you the age of all the things. All right. So I'm going to say that something has changed. We do not install software on devices anymore, and we now use services, and I will explain what all those things are. And I'm going to say that this shift has allowed software developers and companies to incorporate real-time feedback from users in a way that shrink wrap software did not make it possible, and the environment in the environments. And this way, a whole shift happened in business and software development that will explain to us why we have this thing called AI. Okay? And for those that are still not clear, shrink wrap software software used to be put on diskettes, then put in a box, then shipped to a shop. You would buy the box, you would go home, open the box, take the diskettes, and then install your software, unless you use a pirated software, you didn't do the buying part. But basically, it was another time, right? But something has changed. So let me just explain what it is that changed. So the transition from software and diskettes to services that you can now access through, let's say, your browser. So when you use, let's say, Google or any other website that you use is basically practically a service right now. Or you can also be using services through apps installed on your mobile devices is basically the transition we're talking about. And maybe the best way to illustrate this transition is to think about moving away from Microsoft Word to Google Docs. And just because I really want to know this, who has not used Microsoft Word? Okay, so shrink wrap software is still around. Great. All right. So with Microsoft Word, users have to install and manage the software application on their devices. The use of these technologies were not instrumented, so there wasn't constant measurement because there was no way to do so. Companies did not get to capture exactly how their software was used. Updated to a next version of Microsoft Word was something users did every few years. There were things called release parties with Bill Gates dancing awkwardly. Often, thanks to friends sharing their diskettes or serial numbers, people got their software. In the case of companies, they had to pay some pretty serious prices for licensing fees. Now, let's speed forward and look at Google Docs. I'm not trying to promote any of these. It's just like most people have used them. So now the functionality is no longer a software, it's a service, so there's no more software. No installation is necessary. For users, this is said to be great because you do not need to maintain things, and we've all maintained things for relatives, so we know what this means. Documents are easy to share and collaborate. And for software companies, the transition is really amazing. The code remains with the developers, right? Before you put the code, you basically compiled and put it on a diskette and shipped it, it's gone, right? Now the code remains with the developers. This means that they can make changes to the software continuously and release, remember there were release parties, they can release multiple times a day, actually dozens of times a day, new features and new elements to the software. Every interaction users have with the software, in the case of services, can be instrumented. So you can measure every click, every move of the mouse, what you're looking at, et cetera, and capture to identify which features are being used, so which buttons are you clicking on, which features cause problems, where the users lingered their mouse, et cetera, et cetera. This seems like a great convenience for all parties. However, it has great significance for what we call artificial intelligence. First of all, the artificial intelligence I'm interested in relies on this change in software engineering practice and architectures. As a result of the move to services, we now have a lot of data. The typical story is we have a lot of data because processing and storage became cheap. No, we have a lot of data because we have services and we can collect a lot of data. And also it helps that storage and processing became cheaper. Those are different things. As a result of this whole data, the industry has invested massively in centralized processing power because of the potentials of this data collection. In other words, the decision to move to services from shrink wrap software go hand in hand with what we now call cloud infrastructures, cloud being currently the most profitable investment object in Wall Street. This change was very significant for industry. While in the old model of shrink wrap software with waterfall models, et cetera, up to 70% of software would fail. That was a huge cost. With a new model of services, software can be rolled out feature by feature, constantly tested and evaluated, providing an ability to manage risk of failure while optimizing production, a practice we summarize as agile development. This process collapses production and use phases of software development. While with Microsoft Word, you first produce the software, then package, and then there's a use, two different phases. With services, you produce and use, and you use the use to continue to produce. So the two phases are collapsed, in which case we're all working for those software companies to improve the software that they give us. As a result, the use becomes an indispensable part of the production of software. Through these transformations, services have become layers and layers of technologies metricized under the authority of optimization functions. Optimization functions now drive everything. The selection of software features, service integration, cloud usage, user interaction, growth, customer service, environmental capture, so on and so forth. It isn't just the evil advertisers that need the data. Data has by now become the bread and butter of the software industry. Hence the oil of its investors. And these systems are radically different. They leverage the knowledge they gather not to only understand the world, but to optimize it. So it's no longer just about optimizing software engineering or the production itself, but the whole world. They seek to extract economic value through the capture and manipulation of people's activities and environments. They treat the world not as a static place to be known, but as one to sense and co-create. Once scaled up and optimized, our social environments and populations are open to manipulation of a great kind. This causes social risks and harms such as social sorting, referring back to Oscar Gandhi, mass manipulation, asymmetrical concentration of resources, majority dominance, and minority erasure, some of the points that Cesar talked about. In the vocabulary of optimizations, these harms arise due to choosing inadequate objective functions. And we note here that computer scientists that write about optimization and some of its discontent say that these things are just accidents. And we claim that that optimization systems have these problems intrinsically. As in the following, objective functions cause troubles because in the process of increasing the company's bottom line, they may, for example, aspire for asocial or negative environmental outcomes, improve people's ability to, in that sense, most efficiently conduct asocial behavior, They may optimize for some part of the user population, which may increase costs for another part of the population. They may simply live off of the non-users and their environments, etc. The list of negative intrinsic matters that go with optimization systems is long, and for the sake of time, I've been already pointed at. I will keep it short and just give you an example by referring to a rerouting app called Waze. So location-based services, so all of the services that you use on your mobile phones that you can ask for, let's say Google Maps, where how to get somewhere, it gives you a location suggestion. There's another application called Waze, which reroutes you if there's traffic. So it tells you how you can go from A to B and then reroutes you. Location-based services have changed their business model with the shift to optimization systems. They no longer just track and profile individuals to generate spatial intelligence, but they now leverage this information to manipulate users' behavior and create ideal geographies that optimize space and time for their investors' interests. Population experiments go hand in hand with this, using techniques like A-B testing, so that iterative design can be applied to optimize both the software as well as the profits, and also the routes that users are using. Waze reroutes users when there's congestion on a given path, allowing these users to act with a perfect selfishness, an example of one of the externalities of optimization. In some happy universe, this could lead to a socially optimal outcome. Everybody gets everywhere faster. But researchers have found that while traffic-beating apps might work for an individual, they do so at the cost of making congestion worse overall. Waze often redirects users off major highways through suburban neighborhoods that cannot sustain heavy traffic. While useful for drivers, it affects neighborhoods by making streets busy, noisy, and less safe. Consequently, towns may need to fix and police roads more often, and with such systems, even when users benefit, non-users and the environments they inhabit may bear the ill effects of optimization. So, I'll close there with one last paragraph. So smartness, smart cities, smart cars, smart health, whatever people want to call it, is something we are told to expect. And I say that we're told to expect that because it is an existing supply for which we're expected to create a demand. And smartness, under the logic of optimization systems, is pushed not only to ensure success, i.e. return on investment, but it's a way of reordering populations and environments, using logistics and operations control. And as Fenwick McKelvey has pointed out, optimization is not only a technique of logistics and control, but it's a discourse legitimating a mathematical state as a solution to social contention. In that way, it can neither be corrected by tweaking nor by delivering without any regulation, but through intervention into its political economy and the software engineering practices that make it possible. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so over to Barry now. Thank you, Barry.
Thank you, Bev, and thank you all for coming out tonight. Bev is right. My whole team did get kicked out of a think tank called New America last June, June 2017. And we were kicked out because we said some nice things about the European Commission's decision against Google to fine them for violation of antitrust law. And within 2 days, we were told that my entire team, all seven of us, had to be out of New America within 2 months. That's how sort of free thought is promoted by the Google Corporation. And you can read about that in the there was a front page story in the New York Times August 31st by a guy named Ken Vogel. Okay, it's 7:11. I'm just going to make sure I stick to my time. I speak a somewhat different language than Seda or Sita. It's a little blunter. What we do at my organization is we fight power, we fight concentration of power, and to do that, you kind of just have to talk about power. What I'm going to talk about tonight is I'm going to cut my presentation of three parts. The first part is kind of get across the idea that we've seen a complete revolution in the structure of the political economy of the Western nations, of the United States, of Europe, of the UK. A revolution that has entirely restructured power arrangements in these societies. Second thing, point I'm going to make is that we actually now see in the form of the platform monopolist the most awesome machine for manipulation and control of the individual that we have ever seen in our society. And then I'm going to, third point I'm going to make is that this is the gravest threat to our societies, to our democracy, or to our fundamental liberties that we have seen since the Second World War. In the United States, this is probably the gravest threat that we have seen since the Civil War. You know, how was the political economy of the United States structured? And that's the economy I know best. But actually, before I do that, since Seda had people raising their hands, are there any Americans in the room? Okay, we got a few. This is a, because this is, how many Brits are there in the room? Okay. Because I'm going to start off with something that might be a sore point for the Brits, which was the revolution against the Tea Party. I mean, against the British East India Company in the Tea Party rebellion in 1773 in Boston Harbor. Now, what was the purpose of the folks who rebelled against the British East India Company? They did not want an intermediary. They did not want a corporation standing in between the people who make things and the people who buy things. They said, you know what, we can make open markets, and we can use these markets to interact directly with one another without corporations in between us. We do not need intermediaries. We're smart people, and we can, if we structure markets correctly, we can preserve our most fundamental liberties, liberties to make things, to do what we want to do, to think the thoughts that we want to think. Because another thing that markets do is they bring all kinds of information into the public sphere. Liberty for the citizen, that's what people were seeking. In the revolution of 1776, which followed on the Tea Party of 1773, that was where you saw the use of the word citizen, liberty for the citizen. There came a point when people realized that we actually do need intermediaries or corporations that would sort of provide an intermediary role. You know, at the time of the revolution, you didn't have railroads, you didn't have telephone companies, you didn't have telegraph companies. But these things started to be brought online in the 1830s, in the 1840s, in the 1850s. And people said, well, you know, it's like we don't want to get rid of these amazing technologies. They move things really fast. They move thought really fast. They make life better. But that people also realized that the people who controlled the railways, the people who controlled the telegraph company, they were intermediaries. And they had power over the people who were sending thoughts and sending goods across their platforms. So initially, there was a period in which we didn't actually understand what to do about these things. And the people who ran these large corporations, they started to discriminate in their services. They said, well, I'm going to carry your cargo, but not your cargo. I'm going to carry your information, but not your information. They started to discriminate. And they said, well, and the reason they did that, there were two reasons they would discriminate. The first was that it was a way to extort money from all the people who wanted to get to market. It's an extortion machine. If you control the pathway to the market and you get to say, have the ability to choose between who you carry, whose thoughts you carry, whose goods you carry, you get to charge the people who depend on you the absolute maximum they will pay. So it's an extortion machine. The other thing it is, it's a manipulation machine. It's a machine for control. It's a machine for concentrating power. Because eventually you're going to have all these people begging you, I'll do anything for you if you just take my goods to market. I'll do absolutely anything for you. What do you want me to say? I'll go to Washington. I'll say whatever you want to say me to say in Washington if you carry my goods to market and I don't die today, I live to die tomorrow. So people said, well, we can't have these giant corporations in the middle of our society manipulating us and controlling us and concentrating power over us. And so we developed a couple of simple tools to fix that. One of the tools was no discrimination. Posted prices. If you actually are going to carry, if you're going to be an intermediary, you post your prices. You charge absolutely everyone the same price for the same service. Really simple stuff. Common carriage. Actually, you can trace it all the way back to Roman times. You can trace common carriage back to Babylonian times. So anyway, we reinvented it back in the 1830s, 1840s. We applied it to railroads. We applied it to the telegraph. We applied it to the telephone companies. And we also, there was another thing we said. You know what? You also cannot vertically integrate. You cannot be in the business that puts you into competition with people who depend on you to get to market. No vertical integration. So jump ahead to 1970s, 1980s. These simple rules applied over the course of the next 150 years. What they did is they allowed us to bring all of these amazing new technologies to and put them to use, electricity and transportation and communications technologies. And at the same time, we were able to distribute power, keep power distributed, ensure that nobody had the ability, were using these technologies to concentrate power over us, to manipulate us. And that was true in the West, Western Europe, that became true in Japan. All across the democracies, they said, one of the fundamental things is we will not allow the intermediaries to have this kind of control over us. It's basic, it just goes back to rule of law, basic rule of law. There shall be no discrimination. So what happened? Well, some of you know about the Reagan. You guys have heard of Ronald Reagan, right? And you guys have heard of Margaret Thatcher, right? So Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher came along, you know, late 70s, early 80s, and they said, you know, all these rules, all these laws, all these regulations that we use to keep corporations under control and protect markets, we don't need those. These are free markets. We just let them evolve as they want. This is the neoliberal revolution. This was in the Chicago School Revolution in antitrust. So very rapidly, over the course of just a decade or so, all of our major regulatory regimes, our antitrust regime, our trade regime, they applied this kind of new thinking, this neoliberal thinking to these regimes, and they got rid of all the rules that we had used for the past 200 years to protect our democracy against people with power. They did this in 1982 with our antitrust law. They did this in the 1990s with our trade law. Jump ahead to today, we see massive concentration in just about every single sector of the political economy in the United States and in Europe. Not as bad in parts of Europe as in the United States. The United States has been pretty much taken over by oligarchs. Just about every single part of our political economy is controlled by a giant corporation behind which stands an oligarch. But that was only stage one of this concentration of power that was unleashed by this change in law, in practice. But then what happened is into the midst of this new liberalized, radically liberalized, deregulated, as they sometimes call it, political economy, then you had a technological revolution. You had the internet, you had digitization of just about everything. So now, we went from, say, a decade ago, on top of the U.S. Economy, you had corporations like Walmart, you had corporations like News Corp, you guys have heard of them. You had corporations like Citibank were on top of the political economy in the United States. There was massive concentration, you had an oligarchy, but you still had power distributed among maybe 500 corporations. Today, because we have allowed these super corporations to rise up, Google, Facebook, and Amazon, what we see today is this pyramiding of concentration of power into the hands of just a few corporations who have power over these other corporations. They have power over these other corporations because they control their access to market. Rupert Murdoch is a powerful man. But Rupert Murdoch has to depend on Google and Facebook to get his news to market. That means who's the boss of who? And because we did not apply the basic rules that we've been applying to large technology firms since the 1830s, 1840s, the same common carriage rules that we've been using since the beginning of modern time, I mean, the Romans, since the Babylonians. Because we did not apply, because our society, under the sway of the neoliberal idea, under the sway of Reaganism and Thatcherism, we didn't apply those laws anymore. We stopped applying those laws. We now see these super giant corporations, Google, Facebook, and Amazon, with the power to manipulate every single one of us on the consumer side, and the power to manipulate just about every single large corporation on the other side. They have power over everybody in the political economy. They get to determine who talks to who and how they talk and how each person talks to everyone else. Who gets to do deals with whom and how they get to do those deals. That's what Amazon is. They are the central regulator. They're emerging as the central regulator of the political economy of the United States. The central regulator. It's like a Soviet-style regime that we see here, but radically worse than anything any Soviet social engineer could ever have dreamed up. Radically worse. Now, what does this mean? How is this politically? What's the political result of this? And I'm at time now. I'm going to read a quote from my friend, Nick Thompson. Nick Thompson is the executive editor of Wired magazine. I used to know him at New America back in the day when New America was an open place for debate. Cedar worked with me at New America. Cedar remembers New America when it was in a period of transition, but you could still see some of the old ways. But this gives you a sense about the magnitude of the threat we face today because we have allowed these corporations to get to the point of treating each and every one of us differently, to give a different price to each and every one of us, a different terms of service to each and every one of us. That's what discrimination is when each and every one of us is separated from everyone else because we're getting different prices, different terms of service. Now, that's scary when you're going to buy a pen, right? It's like, you know, well, we're going to charge you $10 and we're going to charge you $1 for this pen. You know, that's scary enough. Or when you go to get an Uber ride, they're going to charge you $20 and you $10. You know, that's scary. That's unfair. But when it gets down to the control of information, it is much scarier. So we are now in a position in which Google and Facebook control, as I mentioned before, people like Rupert Murdoch. They control the book publishers. They have the ability to turn things down and turn them up. They have the ability to say, squeal, squeal. And they make these really powerful people squeal. But here, this got snuck in to this article by my friend Nick Thompson. This is an article about Facebook. And it was a generally favorable article about Facebook. It was a favorable article because he writes for Wired. He's executive editor of Wired. He depends on these people for advertising. He depends on these people to get to market. But in the middle of this article, go back and look at it. It was published around February or March of this year. He wrote this. Every publisher knows that at best. They are sharecroppers on Facebook's massive industrial farm. The social network is roughly 200 times more valuable than the New York Times. And journalists know that the man who owns the farm has all the leverage. If Facebook wanted to, it could quietly turn any number of dials that would harm a publisher by manipulating its traffic, its ad network, or its readers. The world we now live in is exactly that. We are all entirely subject to what these guys feed us. But on this even scarier side is that oligarchy that was created over the last 35 years by the overthrow of the democratic economic systems that we established in the United States 240 years ago, is that the oligarchs are now all afraid of these three corporations. So that's discrimination. That's the problem of combining monopoly with data, with a license to do whatever you want to anybody.
Phew, thank you. Well, it's good to kick off the year with some good controversy. Okay, do you have questions for each other? I just want to say I agree. I agree entirely. And putting it in that picture of the kind of from 1776 and the regulations that we had for years and years, to give it the big picture of that deregulation is so incredibly significant, I think. Because the failure to check the power or to even know how that power works, I think that for me is one of the main issues, that it's so hidden, that we cannot actually, it takes a huge amount of research to track the power. It takes a huge amount of front and money to stand up against the power. You get sacked, or your publications don't get placed. It's very, very difficult to resist. And I think, whereas we used to know the political economy of the media, it was Murdoch, you know, we could map it. I remember mapping it in 1980. I had a big map of where, you know, all the media, including the beetle farms that made the ink. We could map it. We could find it. I think now for me, and it would be interesting to have your responses on this, it's the hidden nature, the complexity, the difficulty of actually tracing it, finding it, and then speaking out against it. So I'm very pleased that you're on it, and that was the purpose of this, to actually expose a lot of these inner workings. But if you'd like to respond to those issues a little more, that would be great.
I mean, I would like to thank you both, but I feel like, you know, you started off your talk by saying you wanted to be blunter than us, too, in terms of thinking about the concentration of power, and I absolutely agree. This is a very dire situation that we're in, and the kind of concentration of power is, you know, it feels unfathomable what has happened. At the same time, I feel like that concentration of power is bound up with a legacy of other kinds of concentration of power that aren't only tied to political economy, that aren't only tied or are a revocation of this idea of an open market or the notion of liberty or the, you know, distribution of power and ownership and things of that nature. And, you know, so I think that what I'm both intrigued and provoked by is this idea that we can solve the problem of the concentration of power that exists by only focusing on markets and market power. Because I think that there's a much greater type of social transformation that needs to take place, and that many of the social movements, whether it's you know, social movements that are happening in Latin America around Ni Una Menos or Roads Must Fall or Black Lives Matter, right? There are a number of movements that are cropping up that aren't only, though they speak to the problem of concentration of wealth and economic power, that are only situated in that. So, yes and more.
Go.
I mean, I think that's a terrifically important point. And it's, you know, there's an issue of the order at which you sort of deal with the threat, you know. And one of the things that we have found over time is that actually if you don't keep your society open, if you don't ensure your ability to share information with one another, if you don't sort of ensure that people can be independent, actors within the political economy, it becomes much harder to make the kind of social transformations that you're talking about. Now, and here's an example. You know, in the 50s and 60s, when people were, you know, fighting very hard to promote civil rights, you know, the end, you know, voters' rights in the United States for black folks, and people were going across the South. You know, there was, you know, Thurgood Marshall and Martin Luther King Jr. and all of these people, as they were marching across the South, you know, seeking to educate people, going from court to court, courtroom to courtroom to fight these fights, where would they stay? They had to have a place to stay. Now, they would stay in black-owned hotels. They ate in black restaurants. They stayed in the homes of farmers. They didn't stay in the homes of teachers, because if you stay in the home of a teacher, teacher had a boss. If you stay in the home of a black teacher, that teacher get fired the next day. If you stay in the home of the county employee, and there were black employees in some of these communities, you get fired. It was the distribution of power. It was a distribution of power within the political economy that did two things. It allowed the people to actually do the work of making the reform, because they were able to depend on people who were independent of local structures of power. And it also allowed people to communicate with one another. Right now, we're losing both of these abilities. And if we don't protect them, we are not able to deal with any of these other transformations.
Did you want to respond?
I mean, I think my concern is more that these are global companies. I had the feeling that you had a US-centered representation. And they're a global company with global practices. And if I look at some of the ways they've split up the world in terms of like where the cloud data centers are settled in, so I'm wondering, you know, how to take what you're saying to a more global level, because I don't think it's going to be sufficient to apply this in the classical nation state model and closed markets.
Yeah, and that's also, I mean, that's a terrific, it's a fantastically important point. I mean, we see a short while back, Facebook decided to experiment with how they run their news feeds. And they experimented on five countries, Cambodia, it was Guatemala, it was Bolivia, and I think it was Myanmar, and I can't remember the fifth country. One day, the people in these countries woke up, and like their information systems that they had been relying on to talk to each other were just shut down. They just weren't working. Like, they couldn't get to the media that they had been sort of relying on. And this was just because some guys in Facebook in California decided they wanted to play around. This is absolutely a global phenomenon. I mean, I talk about this, and it's like people in Israel, in Denmark, in Switzerland, they're feeling this same thing, which is that they're losing sovereignty over your information systems, like by the moment almost. Now, that's the bad part of this. These are absolutely incredibly powerful global corporations. But it's not just Facebook and Google. What we're also seeing is a different model that's coming out of China, where you got Alibaba, and you got Baidu, and you got a couple of their very large corporations. Now, the fundamental difference between Google and Facebook is, to a large degree, not complete degree, Google and Facebook are still not integrated with the U.S. government. Baidu and Alibaba are integrated with the Chinese government. The Chinese are using those institutions to control, the Chinese state is using those institutions to control people within China today. And a lot of you know this from the credit scoring system, the social credit system. They're increasing, if you go talk to people in Malaysia, in Thailand, in Singapore, they're freaking out. because they see this imperial system, which is controlled by the Chinese state, that, you know, which is coming to them through Alibaba and Baidu, offering all kinds of goodies. You know, it's like commercial goodies. So, but at the same time, it's actually it's dissolving the controls over there. So this is this is a global problem. Now the good news is that we actually have people like Margaret Vestager in Brussels. We have in the United States we have 50 states with the authority to deal with this. We have. The fact that these are global corporations actually makes them very vulnerable. The fact that we have a model to study over what's happening in China and the environs of China is a very good is very bad for the people who are under that power, but it's a very good thing in terms of teaching us the need to use our nation states right now to fix this problem.
Can I just follow up on that? Because, I mean, if we want to, for example, treat some of these companies as common carriers or public utilities. Do we have examples of a globally defined public utility? Because, I mean, I don't know how I would feel about Facebook, or not me, it's not about personal things, but how many people in different countries and institutions and governments would feel about using an American public utility elsewhere. And I'm not sure, again, how people would feel about if all of a sudden Facebook was a public utility in every country, whatever that would mean, right? And then we would have something like, it would be a public utility in Germany, Turkey, you know, India and China. And, and I'm trying to kind of figure out how to think about some of the propositions that, that you're talking about for a global company.
The internet. The internet's a global utility.
That's right. But
The internet, see, the internet is not Google. The internet is not Facebook. The internet is not Amazon. The internet is a system that was designed by engineers, tens of thousands of engineers and scientists working together all around the world. It's actually this amazing thing, right? Human beings all came together and made this thing that we can all share that allows us to, we can share the system and allows us to engage with each other in all these amazing ways. And Google and Facebook and Amazon have come along and they have monopolized our interaction with the internet. So we actually have the model. The model is just sitting there right in front of us. And it's just really getting, it's just neutralizing Google, Facebook, and Amazon. And we can do that tomorrow.
Okay, I'm going to open it up for questions on that very provocative point. How do we do it tomorrow, obviously? So man in the middle with his hand up. Just put your hand up, say who you are, and then ask the questions, and we'll send the microphones around.
Thank you very much for each of these talks. It was has been very interesting for me to hear each of your perspectives. I'm Martin Dittes from the Oxford Internet Institute. I'm very curious. Every one of you has given great examples of the dysfunctions that these social, technical, or political, economic systems can cause. And the question that formed on my mind as each of you were talking through all these scenarios was to what extent this is maybe not necessarily a question of inclusion or exclusion or merely a regulatory question, but maybe to what extent it's also a question of equity. So a lot of the examples you're given, actually in the words of Seda, they're restructurings of society. So they're happening at a significant scale, maybe in ways in which technologies of the past have done that. Maybe cars did a similar kind of restructuring. But maybe what's happening is that on one hand it's quite intransparent and maybe also quite invisible, as has been mentioned, but also it has a kind of magnitude and a depth and a kind of omnipresence that is quite unusual in how these effects then play out. So what I'm wondering is to what extent we can reframe this in terms of equity, meaning to what extent should citizens, should societies be part of the decision-making processes, the design processes of these kinds of systems. And if we are interested in pursuing that, then what are the personal choices that we might involve in this? What are the means by which public responses might be organized to particular system choices? And what are the regulatory measures that might maybe force these kinds of more equitable arrangements? Thank you.
Okay, there's a lot of questions in that, so why don't you think about that? Three minimum. Are there any more questions? We'll take three at a time. Okay, here at the front of you. So two here and then one there. So are you okay taking three questions at a time and then we'll respond to get a range?
Hi, I have a question for Barry. I was just wondering if you could speculate on what the world might look like now if the deregulation in the 80s that you spoke of didn't occur. How would Facebook, Google, and Amazon look differently today?
Okay, do you want to pass the microphone to your left?
Thank you, everyone. My name is Allison Powell. I work with CETA in the Department of Media and Communications. My question is about change, because I'm curious to hear what you would say about the mechanisms for change or transformation. And specifically, I'm wondering where you sit on the sort of spectrum between untying this from the inside out, thinking perhaps about re-engineering software systems, for example, towards one end, untie or restructure systems or work from the inside out, let's say, to, overthrow them.
Okay, so we'll take answers to those questions. If you want to pass the mic back to the man in the pink shirt, ready for the next round. Okay, would you like to answer those?
So just to the first question, which I think ties to the third question, what I hope is that what I was talking about in terms of inclusion and exclusion is actually that it is very much about equity, and it's very much about justice. And I think that, in terms of the third question, because I think it's related, right, if we're, I have some faith in participating in a governance structure where you would include more people in how we regulate these institutions, these corporations, thinking about, not being monopolized by lobbyists and corporate interests. And I think that's provocative, but limited, because we're not winning. We haven't been winning for a while. And I think one of the responses that I have gravitated towards historically has been, we need to think about how values inform design and what the new internet is going to look like, right, and how it can be actually egalitarian or this and that. And those are also really important questions, and I think tied to playing an inside game. But I'm not as optimistic on either of those fronts, particularly now in the political conditions that we exist. And so when I'm talking about refusal, I see it as a necessity, right? That and as a threat, right? What do corporations really fear? They fear when consumers are outraged about this A-B testing that they didn't know about, like the contagion study, right? They're outraged by that. The delete Facebook movement that recently kind of flared up and then died down, right? And I think that there's more that we can do with that and that we should do with that, because a lot of the internal conversation or the debate about algorithmic fairness seems to legitimize the power of these corporations without fundamentally transforming them. And so I would like to see more work from the outside rather than the inside, because the work on the inside is not working.
Okay, say that.
I think on some level we should take like the societal conditions and the institutions that exist first, in the sense of what are the conditions that a certain population is in, what is the condition that an institution is in before introducing the technology, instead of starting with the technology and saying it has some dysfunctions and we can correct it, and then it can be applied to any institution regardless of in which state they find themselves, right? And you know, we see this in Belgium. A lot of the institutions have no money to integrate themselves into this really fast-paced cloud service thing. And so they don't even have like the choice to enter, so they're kind of excluded. But I think if we start with the situation that we're in, we would maybe even stop having these discussions like, oh, there's fake news and there's polarization and that's why we had Brexit. But we would be like, well, we have an economic and political situation in which certain populations are completely disenfranchised. And it turns out like you can use social networks to reach to these people and mobilize them in effective ways that maybe you don't like if you're part of the establishment, right? Like, this is not to say I'm for Brexit, but it's just to say we have been focusing too much on discontents of the technology without looking at what are the kind of societal institutional conditions that enable them in the first place. And I think we need to already switch to discourse. And I do think that we need to think very clearly about how institutions adopt technology. I think this is really, really powerful. And I mean with institutions anywhere from educational institutions to municipalities to governments having strategies of what does it mean to integrate a service into their structures. And I don't think we talk enough about this. We talk about technology, but not what these powerful, still powerful, losing a lot of power, losing a lot of trust, organizations can still do. The other thing is, I do think that what I say is very in line with Sita, is that I do think that a politics of refusal has to be developed at this point, because this kind of constant push, if you don't integrate AI, you're going to lose out. The only response to that is no, you refuse. And we're not going to lose out, and we're going to win only if we can claim the kind of technologies we want to have. And I think that's turning it around would be my suggestion.
Barry?
Yeah, I'll just answer this first question about, or what was the second question about, what would the world look like? You know, I said that briefly, the world would look much more fair, it would look much more politically safe, and it would actually look much more technologically advanced. And I'll give you just two quick examples. It was sort of the last great antitrust case of the old days, AT&T in 1982. And then the one great anomaly of the last 35 years, which is the Microsoft case in 1999-2000. The AT&T case is what gave us the internet. But that was because of a type of regulation, because of antitrust regulation. It wasn't a top-down regulation. It wasn't the state providing telephone services. It was the state saying to private actors, you can't actually monopolize this. We're going to restructure the market to allow new entrants in. AT&T case 1982, that's what created the pathway for the technological revolution that led to the internet. Microsoft 1999-2000, they're an application, and they said, well, we can actually just run everything on the internet, on your laptop and on the internet. You know, so that was a case in which they're going to say, well, you want a browser, we got a browser. You don't have to go anywhere else for a browser. And the government went in and said, no, we actually just want you to stick to what you do. So the original decision there was to separate the disk operating system from all the products that run on it, the railroad from all the products that run on it. And that classic separation, no vertical integration. And that action led to, gave the space to Google, Facebook, Twitter, all of these corporations that have arisen in the last 10 to 20 years, was made possible by trust busters going in and taking care of, like, greatly limiting the power of Microsoft. So more fair, more safe, more technologically advanced. That's what we get when we use smart regulation through antitrust. But as of, citizens, the role of citizens, I mean, that was an interesting way you framed it. It's like, could we? It's like, this is our right. We're the sovereigns. This is our country. This is our world. It's like, it's not up to us to beg them for permission to to run our country. We just go out there and do it. It's like, it's embarrassing for us to say, can we be involved in some way? Can we have like a little say in what you guys are deciding? That's embarrassing. It's like, none of our parents or great-grandparents or great-great-great-great-grandparents, all of the fights that they fought, did they fight for us to sit here and then beg power for a little say in how things come out? No. I mean, they died in fields of battle. They died, in fighting for civil rights so that we would have dignity and liberty. And to honor their sacrifices, we're going to go and we're going to break up Google, Facebook, and Amazon. And we're going to have this world that is ours.
A Microsoft. And what about Apple? We have a long list. Okay, this is going to be really tough because we only have 8 minutes. And if you've been to public lectures here, if we don't leave the room at 8 o'clock, we get locked in all night, so we do have to finish on time.
Then we can ask all the questions.
Ask all the questions, but there's no food, no water, no toilets. So we will finish on time. The man in the pink shirt definitely had one, and then you were next, and then over there. So there's probably those three. I'm really sorry. We'll probably just have time for those three. So if you can pass that over. So if you'd like to start, yeah.
My name is Tim Francis. I'm a psychologist in private practice. Most of my clients actually come through Google. I wonder what would happen if we got rid of Google.
Okay, do you want to pass it to the front? Have you got the microphone now? Yeah, do you want to ask your question? Then we'll take that one, yeah.
Hiya. My question is, you touched on the point right at the end of your debate amongst yourselves around ownership. And I guess some of you have offered different responses to these giant tech giants that we're kind of living in fear of and under the thumb of. You've suggested refusing to kind of engage their services, which doesn't seem practical for most of us who rely on them every day to do everything. You've talked about diversity in markets and trying to break them up and have smaller ones. But really, don't people just want one big service for the different things they're after? One Maps that doesn't track you, one Facebook that doesn't stalk you. Like, we all tick the box and agree to the terms, but really we just want the service. We don't want the bad stuff with it. And it seems like this is an age of where we really need new tech natural monopolies, right? We need one platform that provides things where people like Beyonce and Drake don't do exclusive deals with one streaming service and not the other. We just want one simple service for the different things we want. How do we get that in an age where we've got nations and we've got these corporations? Is there a different ownership structure here where we can actually have the thing we want without the creeps?
Okay, and then here. One big monopoly platform, yep.
My name's Taylor. I'm a software engineer, and I focus on APIs and microservices. And I'm also studying here at LSE this year.
Great, in good hands.
Wonderful. Okay, so a couple of assumptions. Maybe if we assume that higher levels of, this is sort of a SEBA automation AI question, if we assume that higher levels of automation reduce the number of meaningful or necessary jobs, and which I know can be contested, and therefore reduce the size of labor. There'll be less people in labor, and also that organized labor, like proper organized labor with the power to shut down ports, et cetera, has been historically one of the only sort of powerful, benign ways to reduce inequality. So paint a bleak picture. I'm wondering where you see artificial intelligence and automation and just the rise of ICTs and service-based software, where you see that providing a bright future and potentially increasing the power of the former working and poor.
Okay, so 5 minutes for clients, monopolies, and a bright future.
That's great. I'll take a quick stab. All right, so to the person whose office is listed in Google, you were like, what would happen if we would get rid of Google? And I ask you, what would happen if Google would get rid of you? That's the question, right? And this happens, right? Like, I remember when they removed pictures from Google Maps at some point, or they removed, literally, like, people lost businesses because their ranking changed overnight, and there was nowhere they could go, which goes to the second question, don't we want just, you know, one service centralized for all, and it kind of connects to Martin's question earlier. Centralization means that governance is centralized, and optimization means that unless the numbers start hurting, you're not going to respond to people. So if one person has a problem, they're not going to care. If a few million people or some of their favorite customers have a problem, they might respond. And so it becomes very utilitarian logic, so that's one of the biggest problems of this kind of centralization optimization logic. But also, we need local governance and difference. Right, and we don't want, for example, the same. I mean, I think when we look at, you know, services like Airbnb and how they basically cause mayhem in cities like Barcelona and London and Amsterdam, this is like the same logic being applied to all the cities, not looking at their different needs, right? And I think we would benefit from innovation that takes our local needs and governance seriously. So I don't believe in the centralized one service for all, even if it's not creepy. Bright future. Okay, I'm going to think about that one. Okay.
Sita, do you have a bright future?
I actually think what Sita's saying. I think what Sita's saying is really, really powerful, because I think, you know, we've brought together different people. I can just say from my personal experience working on systems and algorithmic discrimination, whatever, and it was very important for them to, for a moment, to say, what if we don't want one of these systems? And I think it's really one of those cases where we're learning from movements and struggles that, you know, sometimes we need to pause and think about what we do and don't want. And I think that's where the bright future is, if we can pause and think before services come and optimize us.
Any responses? You're going to see.
I'm just sorry. I'm like stuck on your question partly because I'm thinking, you know, if we had one centralized service and I want more than Drake and Beyonce, I'm in trouble, right? Because I think sorry, it's the end of the night. But you know, I don't actually think that's what we want. And I do, you know, I want to acknowledge what Barry is arguing for, that we need greater distribution here in the kinds of technologies that are provided, right? And at the same time, we should be able to directly intervene and interrupt in this process of optimization, which otherwise won't allow us to intervene, right? I think that we're not going to get the golden, I don't know, the unicorn or whatever it is that you're excited about in terms of our technological future. I think you know, we have to be a little bit more honest and frank about thinking about when and how we shouldn't actually have technological systems integrated into our social lives.
Okay. Yeah, we, I think both the first two questions were both really important. And actually, we at my organization, we ran a campaign for a number of months beginning in April when there was the hearings on Facebook in the Senate in the United States after the Cambridge Analytica scandal. And there was this delete Facebook campaign that was out there. And our campaign was, which brought together a bunch of different groups, including some of us and the Demand Progress and Public Citizen. But our campaign was, we call it Freedom from Facebook. And the thing that we did not want anyone to, we didn't want to say that you have to give up Facebook. You know, if somebody has spent thousands of hours building a profile on Facebook, you know, if you have put your life on Facebook, and to come into their life and say, oh, you got to give up Facebook, you should delete it, you should just, you know, get off of there and just move, you know, just find something else to do. Take up stamp collecting. You know, it's that's really unfair to people. And this is true also with Google. You know, when I say break up Google, I mean it. There's like, say, Google is, you want to break it up vertically so that it's not competing with the people that depend on it. In the case of Google, there's some of you kind of want to take YouTube separated from Maps and separated from Android. These things don't need to be tied together. But if you have, at the end of the day, one major search engine and one major mapping system, that may be actually the rational way that these things come out. Maybe there is a natural monopoly. We've seen that in the past. Maybe we want that, like on Amazon. If the people of the world want to put all of our information about books on one platform, share it on one platform, that's our right if we choose to do that. But then the question is the system itself safe? And we can make it safe using these tools. We can make sure that we have one place, but it serves us. It doesn't allow them to make us serve them. And so that's absolutely possible. And in terms of like, what's the bright future is that we take these amazing technologies. I mean, Google is just awesome. The search system is awesome. You know, it's like, I am a writer. I've written for a long time. When Google really came on, it's like, it sped up my access to information phenomenally. I remember that, you know, and it's like, and Facebook, the ability to communicate with people, these are astounding things. But these technologies belong to us. They don't belong to Eric Schmidt. They don't belong to the folks on Wall Street. They don't belong to Mr. Zuckerberg. They don't belong to Jeff Bezos. He has monopolized these technologies. These people have monopolized these technologies. These are our technologies, and we will have them, again, serving us. And then the future, when we control these technologies, is of democracy, of an inclusive society, once again, not just a possibility, but a growing reality, like a real, just, and fair world. We can begin to remake that, to make that again, when we have control of these technologies, which is very easy to do.
Okay, thank you. I'd also like to say it was great to see so many questions, and I do apologize for not being able to take them. There'll be more opportunities. This is, I would argue, the issue for our times that we need to know more about, and ending on the digital commons, that's the bright future. Thank you.